Welcome to Gola, the podcast about Italian food and culture. I'm Katie Parla, a Rome-based food and beverage writer, culinary guide, and cookbook author.
And I'm Danielle Caligari, a lecturer in Italian studies at UC Berkeley and a certified specialist of wine.
Buongiorno, Danielle.
Buongiorno, Katie. We are still shoving our way through as many podcast episodes as we can while we're together. And after a few of your patented Instagram posts, you noticed that we were getting lots of questions from our wonderful fans, and we decided that we would dedicate an episode to answering questions.
Yeah, it's a little mailbag app.
We've got a mailbag app for you, and we have, I think, probably a running list of questions from fans that we will try to add to and maybe pepper into future episodes as well. But for today, we have some fresh ones that came in hot off the presses for us and that we found to be actually really great questions, a lot of them. We were really impressed with some of the thoughtful choices that people made when they were trying to squeeze us for information.
Yeah. So Raffaele Alessia asks, I have 4 hours in Roma Centro. Where do I eat?
Katie, this one's on you, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, I do a three-hour Centro Storico food tour, and I know my way around Rome really well, so I don't get lost. But if you got 4 hours and, you know, it's a short trip, all the better. So when you have a little difficulty navigating with the idiosyncratic GPS and unplanned city streets, you got a little more time. So I would start with a coffee at Caffè Rosciani, which is a great pastry shop. I'd have a cornetto or a maritozzo and a double espresso. I'm a double espresso type person. I'd head over to the Rosciani family's bakery for some pizza al taglio, their pizza rossa, a slice of their pizza adorned with some olive oil and tomato sauce is my pick. I'd then head over to Forno Campo dei Fiori, pausing to cry over the absolutely abysmal state of the Campo dei Fiori market. But in the corner of that square is a great pizzeria, or rather bread bakery, that has a little annex where they serve, this time of year it's, you know, July, prosciutto and fig sandwiches, but year round you'll find mortadella sandwiches. They are awesome. If I wanted some craft beer, I'd go to Open Balladine. If I wanted natural wine, I'd go to Il Piccolo or L'Angolo Divino. And I'd wrap it up with a gelato at Gelateria dei Gracchi. And forgot one very critical and important stop, slice of ricotta cake or some pizza braica at Boccione, the kosher bakery in the ghetto.
That's a pretty slick lineup, Katie, I have to say. I approve across the board, I think.
I'd also add that if you wanted to have a sit-down meal during that four-hour period, I go for a late lunch at Armando al Pantheon, you know, try to sneak in at 2:15 or so.
Yeah, I think you can usually do that. Next up, Katie?
Nodo Pizzas asks, best place for food, Amalfi Coast.
So I saw this question before and I said the thing that I always say, which is the best place for food on the Amalfi Coast is not the Amalfi Coast. It's anywhere nearby that isn't water adjacent, probably, and especially that isn't part of the super expensive luxury scene that's kind of up and down the coast there. But Katie, you know, you probably have been back around there touring or at least researching for your recent book. So what do you say?
I like Lo Stuzzichino above Sorrento as like a down-home type of spot. There are tons of fancy places that you can get to with boats or by hiking down rock-hewn staircases. But, I mean, frankly, I don't fuck with the Amalfi Coast. Yeah. I do like Vico Equense,
yeah,
which is the town just before the Sorrentine Peninsula. And there's this place I love to go to, this beach club. It's called Bikini. And they do a fantastic spaghetti with clams. And they got this little stretch of, well, sort of dock slash beachy type sitch on the Bay of Naples. And you can see Vesuvius, and it's awesome. And then Osteria Nonna Rosa, also in Vico, is great. I mean, I think like most people who really are after an experience that surrounds you with locals and makes you feel like you're in a place that was developed for locals, I avoid the Amalfi Coast, which was actively developed, albeit by locals, for an Anglophone tourist community, upper class tourist community, and it's remained that way for decades.
Yeah, I think that's a very good summary. I would elaborate on your point about Sorrento, also Pian di Sorrento. That's probably the first and last place where you can find some very decent restaurants because Sorrento, even while it is sort of part of the Costiera, it's also a little bit bigger and a little bit more inhabited. So there are more substantial places there that aren't just seasonal and just for tourists, I think. Yeah. Although it's been a little while. Yeah.
I would also hit up the Naples / Amalfi Coast page of my website for intel on cool sort of tavern-y type things in the Amalfi Coast, a great salami shop, sausage maker, and you can find that at katieparla.com. Just scroll down the page and look for the city guides and click on Naples.
The next thing we have is a request for an episode on porchetta.
Queen of Egg Rolls has asked an episode on porchetta, and we both reply,
yes. Next one.
Overrated Italian food from Brunicots. Also, yes.
Yeah. This one got us going right away. So, I don't know. What's the first thing you think, Katie? What pops into your head when you hear it?
Every time I think of overrated, I think of Pierluigi in Rome or Macaroni in Rome, two places that are super famous and inexplicably so. They've captured the attention of celebrities. They serve truly bad food. Macaroni is a little bit more disgusting on the plate, and Pierluigi is just really gross from a materia prima, raw material standpoint. They sell really overpriced, very low quality fish that's gussied up in the kitchen.
And while we're on specific places that are overrated, I can tell you that in Florence, actually, there are a few places now, or I know you would just say the city, period. Mm. But
we'll see the region.
What I would say is that there is a sandwich shop, the name of which I will not even deign to mention, which is, I think, currently rated the best restaurant in Florence on TripAdvisor and has so thoroughly captured the tourist imagination that the street traffic is completely blocked.
Does it do giant sandwiches?
Giant sandwiches. Sandwiches that are offensive in a series of ways. One, because the size is such that no normal person should be eating that, even for two meals, frankly. But the other is that they just make sandwiches. Many places in Florence make excellent sandwiches. Scacciata, the kind of focaccia that you find in Florence, is delicious, and any bakery worth its salt, yes, you're welcome, puns will abound in this episode, I'm sure, is going to be making a really good base, and then all you have to do is throw on some good affettati, another thing that Tuscany is decent at least, if not very good at. So, you know, go to places for basics like Katie's talking about in Rome with pizza rossa or other things that we can use as analogies to that in Tuscany or elsewhere. You know, go to a small local place and not to the place that everybody says is the best, because the place that everybody says is the best, it turns out, is misleading also because crowdsourced sites that are run by Anglophone communities cannot source information about how people in that place would feel about that food. That's a very long way of saying just be skeptical about what other Americans who don't have a lot of good points of reference say about food in place.
I would also add that it's easy to find delicious and classic things in non-restaurant venues, and often it's the bakeries and pastry shops that are underrated or underappreciated. Yeah. Because if you're on holiday and you're in Italy, you probably have this idea that you should be sitting down to meals twice a day, or three if you're into breakfast. But I would say in a lot of places in Italy, locals don't go out. So trattorias and ristoranti exist for tourists, not just tourists from the US or Northern Europe, but also from Italy. And like, it's always so chilly. And I know that you're headed to Palermo, but a lot of places in Sicily and Puglia and so forth, I found are really crafted for like rich Milanese.
Yeah.
They're made for wealthy people from the north.
Definitely.
And that type of audience rather than serving a local public.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, that's how restaurants and taverns were born, right? For visitors, a person who lived in a place would never have need of eating outside the home. It was if your home wasn't there and you needed to find a place to eat. So that is actually a really good rule of thumb to keep in mind, Katie. I like it.
All right. Other Animal asks, how did you guys meet up before starting the podcast? Other Animal, I appreciate you and your Philly accent.
We've been practicing them actually for the last 12 to 14 hours. So
it's hot. I want to go down to shore, but the order's to order.
I'm trying, but I can't succeed. Long Island is as far as I can get. We met while I was still living full time in Italy also, and I was planning to teach a suite of courses on food studies in Florence. I ended up getting a job in California and moving that project to California instead, where I also dragged Katie. But when I was planning on doing this in Italy, I reached out to Katie to see if she wanted to collaborate. And also because I secretly planned to make her my friend, and I succeeded, as I do in almost all of my secret plans.
And we met at Litro.
We did. We
had a glass of wine and probably some salted anchovies with butter and toast.
I mean, if there were butter and anchovies available, we ate them, that's for sure.
So Paul Tuerto asks, are there any Italian-American dishes that have made their way back to the motherland? I couldn't think of any.
This is a good question. We thought about it for a minute. I don't think that there are any that have really done that trajectory specifically, which is to say, been invented without any real kind of initial inspiration in Italy, in America, and then brought back to Italy or brought to Italy. So just that one arrow pointing in that direction. There are definitely dishes that kind of communicate across the Atlantic. One of my favorite ones is mozzarella in carrozza, which is just a big mozzarella stick, basically. Everybody loves fried cheese. You find it in almost every diet. You can easily imagine why it works really well no matter where you bring it up. Although I do, of course, love the Italian version better because, speaking of anchovies, there tends to be one sneaking in there and you rarely find an anchovy in your mozzarella stick at Olive Garden.
I mean, but what you do get is marinara on the side.
Katie loves a little side marinara, yeah, that's for sure.
It's true. So I was thinking about this too. And, you know, at the turn of the 20th century, millions of Italians went to North America. And over the course of the next several decades, I think about a quarter returned, like retired or resettled in Italy. So there must be some examples of, you know, rural trattorias or sandwich shops or bakeries that borrowed some things. Actually, I'm thinking about something right now. Okay, so this is not an Italian-American. It's an Italo Canadese tradition.
Oh.
At Antico Forno Roscioli in Rome, in the 70s, they had a Canadian baker who, like, made white bread.
Oh.
And the tramezzino white bread, oh, which is really typical of the North, mm-hmm, Pierluigi Roscioli, the owner of this bakery, says it's not related. The one that they serve is, like, not related to any type of Northern tramezzino sandwich tradition, but instead was the product of this Canadian baker's white bread recipe that took off and became a popular bakery thing here.
That is a great example. And also now I'm thinking maybe we should write a book about Americans who sneaked back into Italy through their bread or other recipes like that.
It's kind of
great. Yeah.
So Mama Loaf 8 asks the best question. I don't want to pit you guys against each other, but she wins. I love this one. What is something rude or offensive in an Italian restaurant that is acceptable in the USA? So many things.
I know. I was just about to say this one really could give us a whole episode in itself. The first thing that I would say to this is just rushing in general. I feel like I always see Americans, or also when I'm with people, they're always kind of looking around, wondering why they're not getting more attention, flagging down wait staff, and especially when it comes to the check, getting annoyed by the fact that the server won't drop the check. It's considered very bad taste here to leave a check before the person has explicitly asked for it. And even then, there's often a tendency to kind of dally on bringing that because the feeling is that traditionally, again, using the word loosely because our whole point is that dining out wasn't very traditional at all. But in any case, in local places that serve locals, you would get a table and it would be yours for the night. They weren't doing a turn. So if you see in Rome, a lot of the really old places still only open at 8:30, 8:45, 9 o'clock. And that's because that would be when you came in, you sit down and you eat. That's it. There's nothing else happening. There's nobody coming to take your seat from you. And there was no reason to rush anything, especially because you were spending money. So, the suggestion that you should do it in any way other than at the most leisurely pace just doesn't make sense to them. And that, of course, is the opposite of what especially fast casual establishments in America propose as hospitality, which is instead everything as soon as you ask for it or barely thereafter.
Yeah, and I would say once you've asked for the check, your server's job is done.
Yeah.
Right? They've already passed that message on to the owner or whoever's handling the bills. Often it's not the server that generates your bill, but some manager or someone else. So it's very bad form to express your rage at your server because you haven't gotten your bill. Someone else is looking after it and you got to be patient. And like patience and sort of like observing your surroundings is important, I think. There is a structured menu at most places. So your antipasto is followed by your primo, your secondo, your contorno, your dolce. There is almost never coffee listed there. So I would steer clear of asking for a cappuccino or a coffee before the very end of your meal. I think a lot of places will serve it to you now, but some won't. Some will just say like, no, we're not serving that. It's not the time in the meal for that. And I think that also goes for salads and things that many Italian Americans, including myself, are accustomed to eating at the beginning of the meal, whereas in Italy, it's served with or after your main.
Yeah.
So take a look around, see how other people are eating. Hopefully you've followed one of our dining recommendations and are eating at a place that real live Italians are frequenting, so you can see them at work. And, oh, beginning of the meal people ask for butter or olive oil to dip their bread in, or olive oil with balsamic vinegar.
Worst of all.
None of these things are typical, except in a fine dining venue where you may be given bread and butter, a bread basket with some sort of emulsified olive oil spiked with some flavor. In trattorie, your bread is for soaking up whatever's left on your plate. There is no glassware or serviceware for a little bowl of olive oil at your table. Olive oil is a condimento. You can drizzle it over your steak or over your salad. And balsamic vinegar, which is from the area around like Modena and Bologna, is a salad dressing condiment and not something to mix.
It shouldn't even be, balsamic vinegar really shouldn't be present anywhere at all that you go outside of Emilia Romagna broadly, maybe opening up to that in general. If there's a place that is specializing in that kind of cuisine or that brings out a vinegar as an acid component in some other dish on the table, great. But if a place is willing to provide it for you, it means that it's bad. It's actually almost certainly not balsamic vinegar. It's masquerading under that name and it doesn't belong at the table. So not only should you not be asking for it, you should be very suspicious if you see it around at all, frankly.
I mean, I would say every spot on the entire peninsula has like a shitty bottle of Ponti brand balsamic vinegar sitting around. It's super bracingly acidic and it's this sort of uber cheap mass-produced vinegar. So maybe if you're like into trying something that's a little bit more balanced, ask if they have some white wine or red wine vinegar or a wedge of lemon.
Yeah, perfect for a salad. Exactly. Yeah.
I'm trying to think of other things. I think it's more like attire. Italians don't wear shorts at dinner, and nor do Italian men generally wear shorts. I would say that, looking outside right now, it's 85 degrees at 8:30 in the morning. It's about to be a scorcher out there. And I've seen many, 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 many Italian cabs parading around under a pair of shorts recently. This is very rare.
This is a new thing.
It's a new thing and it's rare, but no one wears shorts at dinner. Ball caps at dinner.
Oh God, yeah, no. Hats inside, no.
Non-fashionable sneakers. Like, leave your white New Balances at the hotel. And if you have like a very cool, super expensive pair of fashionable Nikes, like maybe you can get away with it. But I would say dress it up a little. You don't have to be super formal, but take into consideration that people notice what you're wearing.
Yeah, there's a kind of a respect for others and yourself that is expressed through wearing clothes that have been selected, not because they're expensive or fancy, but because they're specifically for being out and about in front of other people as opposed to your inside clothes. I do want to add one more thing to the list of items, just because I can't wait to get Katie started on this, which is, and I'll do it through an anecdote. Last week I was sitting down in a very old traditional place in Florence, the kind of place where you really do eat your whole meal, from antipasto to dolce, because they bring small portions. I mean, a really kind of old school place. And people next to me ordered not cappuccino with their dinner, which might have been worse, but can you imagine, Katie, what the other drink item that they might have decided was appropriate for an Italian meal?
Please don't say milk.
No, Katie, I'm sorry. I didn't even think of that, but that is worse. It's in between. It's your least favorite alcoholic beverage.
Oh, spritz.
You got it.
You they don't carry drink spritz through with dinner. Spritz isn't for dinner. Sprints don't go with meals. I know, listen, I'm telling you this for your benefit. Spritz doesn't go with a meal. Don't order it with a meal. You're making a fool of yourself. Done with that. I'm so sorry, but, you know, I've been here far too long. I have these visceral responses to things.
No, I actually, when I saw it, I also felt almost nauseated by the idea of it, because a spritz already, you're right. I mean, it's sugary. There's no other way of saying it. So,
would you order a fruit punch with your dinner?
Yeah,
your
that's carbonara? What it's like. Yeah.
But I mean, aside from that, like, the spritz is now globally famous because Aperol/Campari have marketed it as something synonymous with, like, the Dolce Vita, an Italian lifestyle. Yeah. It's an aperitif. So by all means, have a spritz, even with Aperol if you really must, at the beginning of your night. But once you sit down to a trattoria, get vino.
Yeah.
Or Coca-Cola, for that matter.
At that point,
that's totally fair game, actually.
Yeah, you're better off with a gassosa, for sure.
Please twirl your spaghetti. Please twirl it. Now, you might offend people if you use a spoon to twirl it. For some reason, Italians don't really love when you do that. But
yeah.
I don't have a problem with it. Do not cut your spaghetti.
Oh, yeah, don't
or
cut.
Or most pastas with a knife. That's
another one. Actually, there's probably a whole episode on that, but let's keep going because we're not going to get to some of the good ones. Our next question is a wonderful question from J.M. Butler. Do Black Italians have a special way of cooking? So this is a question that can be answered in a few ways. I think it's worth dropping a little bit of history here to explain what the Black community in Italy is like so that people can understand what kind of cooking might blend cultures there, as well as be more thoroughly landed in Italian identity right now. So one thing is to understand that under fascism, Italy had a kind of semi-failed colonial experiment that they don't really like to talk about and frequently elide, especially right now, as they're wondering why there are so many people coming from specifically North and East Africa up into the peninsula. This is a legacy of an attempt to conquer places that are now Libya, Tunisia, especially Ethiopia and Eritrea, and a series of islands in the Mediterranean with more or less success. Mostly less. Italy had to pull its interests out of Ethiopia and Eritrea and the Dodecanese, a number of other places following the defeat of Mussolini's regime. And that has mostly meant that there isn't a huge Italian adjacent community of people who were educated under an Italian system during colonialism. However, there are still some people who come from those places who grew up speaking Italian and learned Italian in a place that was under Italian control and then came later or during that time to Italy and brought with them traditions from those places. Then there are also both longer standing traditions of people from communities from, again, North and East Africa or the Middle East. And then there are newer traditions that come with people who have arrived in the last several years. Katie, your finger on the pulse when it comes to what people are doing right now. So do you have an idea of how people of mixed heritage or of Black Italian heritage are cooking right now, or what flavors they're using?
Yeah, I mean, certainly people from Ethiopia and Eritrea are continuing at home to reproduce classics, Dora Watt, Zigini, mm-hmm. Which is definitely a household name in Italy. Most most Italians would have at least heard of that spiced and slightly spicy beef stew. In big cities, there are places that serve African food from various regional places, often takeaways, and especially in areas that are hubs for immigrant gathering, in, for example, the Casilina in Rome, Tor Pignataro, and heading up the Prenestina, as well as around the train station. But in terms of a sort of formal dining out type of setting, it's really Ethiopian and Eritrean places that are accessible to the middle class. And that's where Italians, Black and otherwise, might encounter African food in a more formal dining setting.
Yeah, and then there are some more obvious blends. I know, for example, that there is a style of lasagna that is very popular in Ethiopia that people who are now, I think, would consider themselves maybe more firmly Italian than anything else would look to as a kind of recipe that represents both a mixed heritage and something that is, you know, kind of clearly Italian, but brings in the spices that you're talking about, Katie, that are essential to East African cooking. And I think it's also just worth pointing out that many of the things that we consider to be Italian, Black, white, or otherwise, are influenced by communities that are non-white and have always been. There's a big, big misconception that particularly Islamic communities are new to the Italian peninsula. Katie and I have talked about this before, and I'm sure we'll talk about it again in other contexts. Muslims, Jews, and Christians, as well as representatives of other major and minor religions, have always lived on the Italian peninsula since as long as we've been bothering to talk about, at least as far back as ancient civilizations here. There have been mixed communities and mixed influences. So to say that one thing belongs to this versus that, at some point we begin to bleed into a space that is not that easily definable. And that's part of what makes Italian cooking rich in the first place, because it is a geographic space that reaches into an area that has really different possibilities when it comes to the landscape of cooking.
Yes. And when we reflect on Italian cuisine and cultural heritage, we have to resist, sort of buy into the impulse that many Italians have, which is to erase the influence of foreigners or people who come from outside their immediate tribal boundaries.
Exactly.
So Bourbon Treats and Window Seats asks, any tips on finding good wine when surrounded by chains that seem to carry the stuff? The bad stuff.
Yeah.
So, as is so common, I'll let you know something about how the wine biz works in Rome. A lot of restaurants and hotels and wine shops themselves rely on Bernabei or other very large distributors that provide storage, budget prices, and all sorts of conveniences. And so many of the wine shops in Rome and trattoria menus feature the same subpar or mediocre or sometimes just straight up bad choices. I would say if you walk into a wine shop and there's like an Antinori section or an Antinori wall or Castello Bonfi is represented in some way, those sort of big commercial Tuscan bottles are red flags that you're in a place that doesn't take wine seriously or at least is trying to leverage some sort of perceived Tuscan primacy as a marketing angle. The Enoteca is a long established business in Italian cities. It's where people would go and fill up their own vessels with wine, oil, grappa, all sorts of liquids. And some of these, like L'Angolo Divino in Rome's historic center, which opened in 1946, or Il Goccetto, which dates back to 1980, offer a selection that is much more curated and much more reflective of the Enotecaro's tastes than the local distributors' tastes and demands.
Yeah, this problem is the same in the U.S. So if you're thinking of your ability to consume while you're at home, and assuming we're talking anyway outside of Italy, looking for Italian wines and trying to find something that isn't bad, we'll put it in scare quotes. There are a few ways that we can define bad, but in any case, the same issues are going to be at play. Big distributors control a lot of what people can get, and to get around them can be really difficult. At the very least, it means that the shop owner or restaurant owner or beverage director has to, on their own, source everything that they bring into their establishment. And that takes, probably about 200 times as much work as just having a distributor come and taste you on the wines in their portfolio and then leave it at, you know, whatever works for you and whatever price point seems to suit the needs of your establishment. It can be hard, even when you're being thoughtful, to find a place that is going to source well for you. And what I do for almost everybody I buy for in America is go through the internet, which I regret means sometimes not patronizing your local shop, but it is often the way to make sure that you get to taste some things that otherwise are unavailable, because not everybody is living in the New York metropolitan area or the Bay Area and has a local shop that is in a comfortable driving distance or accessed in some other way. On the other hand, if you do have a shop that is dedicated to wine and spirits near you and isn't like a Total Wine or a massive a kind of supermarket style shop, you can go to that business owner and say to them, I would like these things. In fact, you can be very specific and say, I specifically want this bottle, this producer, this vintage. You can, on the other hand, say, I'm really interested in trying some smaller producers, practicing biodynamic techniques or not using certain kinds of styles of production, and just say, can you find some stuff like that? I'll come in, I will buy, I will encourage my friends and family and local acquaintances to buy. And you'll find that often a shop owner will be very willing to do that. Their concern when they bring in something that's new or different is that nobody's going to buy it. If you in advance tell them, I want it, they are, you know, going to be more comfortable and more likely to take that plunge for you. So the very long answer to a short question is, how to get good stuff when you're surrounded by the bad with wine or anything else is you have to be the proactive one, I think.
True. Oxen81 asks, favorite Italian list, favorite Italian movie list for you both?
Katie, you, I think, jumped right to some classic comedies that would be, I think, really accessible for people, though, actually. What were you thinking of?
I mean, classics from Verdone, like Bianco Rosso e Verdone. Thomas Millian, who's a Cuban-Italian actor, did a lot of like cops and robbers movies, and those are very low budget and very entertaining. Sort of, yeah, like candy. Fun to watch.
Yeah, I think an example of something like that, equally fun, lots of silliness, but with some real serious cinematic value, are the Commedie all'Italiana. So Mario Monicelli is a director you can look for, worked with some of the great actors of the Italian cinematic tradition, and nonetheless has some really funny films. Probably the most famous one is I Soliti Ignoti. There's Marcello Mastroianni, who you'll recognize from La Dolce Vita, Notte e Mezzo, if not others. There's Vittorio Gassman. So you can also look for these actors names and things to find classics that are both beautiful and fun. I'm a big fan also of Michelangelo Antonioni, although his films tend to be a little bit more challenging. They are definitely a little bit more difficult, but they're very, very beautiful. And they really capture Italy in a way that is compelling. He also happens to have done lots of other interesting work in the U.S. You might have heard of Zabriskie Point. Other things more recently, you know, everybody's probably hot on Luca Guadagnino already, who's I Am Love, Bigger Splash, and most recently, Call Me By Your Name, not most recently, sorry, Call Me By Your Name, most recently, Suspiria remake. And then Paolo Sorrentino is the other name that has been all over the U.S., whose films I think have gotten more attention lately, but have gotten less interesting. His earlier stuff is great. Look out for L'Uomo in Più. I think it's translated as The Extra Man, for example. Anything else people should be hot on in Italian culture right now, Katie?
I mean, what's hot, because it's on Netflix, is Suburra, which was a movie and now a series. It's kind of trashy and like not super well acted, but it covers the sort of Ostian mafia and Roma Sinti intrigue. Of course, Gomorra is super, super famous and popular, covering the Gomorra and the culture around the Neapolitan
mafia. Yeah. I watched Baby recently.
Oh, yeah?
Did you?
No.
I don't know if I would recommend it, but in any case, if you want to feel close to Italian culture, Netflix shows are really fun to kind of dip a toe in while you're on the other side of the pond. I think we have to wrap up, Katie, because as expected, Mailbag has eaten up more time than any of our episodes because our fans are wonderful and throwing tons of excellent questions at us. I think we'll try to do this more often because it's also fun. I like it for us, too. It kind of gets us thinking and probably also lets you hear us in the process of trying to work out some of the things that we talk about in hopefully a slightly more managed way in other other episodes.
In the meantime, send us your questions, DM us, or email us. You can find us at golapodcast.com, anchor.fm/gola. I'm at Katie Parla on Instagram and other social media platforms.
I'm at Dr. Caligari's Cabinet on Instagram. And while you're cruising around the internet, do make sure to subscribe to give us our 5-star rating on iTunes or your preferred podcast provider. And let your friends know that they should listen to us. We need you just as much as you need us, probably more, because otherwise we'd be talking to ourselves in Katie's kitchen, which it turns out we do with microphones anyway, but in any case, let people know, pass the word. We love making the show, but we do need to have support to make it happen. So the more people listening, the more we can do for you. Look out for more episodes. We just locked and loaded a whole bunch, and we can't wait to hear more from our favorite golosi around the world.
Arrivederci.